Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to part two of my lovely chat with the lovely, lovely Sean, lovely Faye. If you haven't heard part one, go get it in the feed before you listen to this. Here we go.
When I was reading the book, I think one of the things I really felt was it had the quality of something that had been around forever. Like it felt like this book had always existed. It was so remarkable what you were saying and how you were saying it. And I know a lot of people have said that there's a quality about it that is incredibly accessible. And it's, you feel like you're learning loads, but also I feel like I'm in a conversation with you. But one of the things I took away from it was, do you ever sit back and go, what a fucking time to be alive, that I think it's important to recheck that you really should not be being treated like this, and there should never be any normalizing of that, you know, that you have to write an argument for justice, you know? And what does that feel like? Do you have a sense of that, or do you allow yourself to have a sense of that?
I don't always allow myself to. I think I enter quite a calm space because I've realized before anger has never really served me that well, and that's just a personal observation. I mean, it shouldn't be. The only time that I really noticed it was when I read the audiobook, because I read my own audiobook, and you do it in 3 days, like a 9 to 5 in a studio with like an hour for lunch. And obviously, like, I'd read the book so much, because the book is, you know, you read the final form of the book, so it was just about a month before the book was published. And I'd read the book several hundred times, it felt like, because obviously you go through so many proofreading stages, copy editing, etc. So I was very, very familiar with the text. But I think it was because I had to read it aloud in such a contained space of time with very little breaks and things like that. And actually, on the second day, I think it was, where it was like the chapter about sex workers and the chapter about prisons, like both quite heavy chapters. Mm. And actually, I found it really upsetting and really distressing. Yeah. It was for the first time ever. And I think it was actually having to read that aloud, you know, reading things that like awful things that had happened to trans people. And realizing, you know, like, I think I'd had this distance where it's like, well, I'm a privileged trans person, so this sort of stuff doesn't happen to me. You know, I'm not a street sex worker. Mm. And that's true. But like, obviously, I identify with it because it's like, well, if it was if I'd had a couple of different things happen in my life, it could have been me, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I've suddenly found it really, really upsetting. And actually, that was like a point where I was like, this shouldn't be normal. I shouldn't have to do this. I shouldn't have to rehearse really traumatic things and present this kind of case for the humanity of an entire group of people, particularly a group of people who experience all of this like shit, basically. I am wary of that. But at the same time, what alternative is there? Because unfortunately, what I think people are counteracting, particularly in the UK, but you know, in the US, actually around the world, like, you know, it's as bad in Hungary and Poland and Spain. Mm. They have a similar moral panic there about trans people in Spain, actually. And in the, you know, is that like, unfortunately, there's this huge global anti-gender movement, but like anti-trans movement. And if I don't, you know, if you don't make an argument for it, there's just no one will. Like, you know, that's unfortunately where we're at. And it's sort of done. The book is, for people people who haven't read it, the book is quite hopeful, I think. And I wanted it to be because I didn't want to depress people. Mm. But yeah, it's written in the hope that like it will make itself obsolete, you know, hopefully shorter period of time than I would imagine. There is the hope for that. And I was going to say about the point about it being having feels like it's been around forever. The one thing is that, like, I mean, if I know people never really look unless they're like trying to catch me out or whatever. No one's going to go through all the end notes because like what loser would do that unless they're studying the book for an academic thing or they're trying to like screw me over. But the, you know, the end notes of the book, like most of the citations in the book, and there's yeah, loads, are other trans people. And the reason I mention that is because like a lot of that thought in the book, a lot of the arguments, you know, I do have make some, you know, Sean Fay originals, but like a lot of them are arguments that have been around for a long time. Like the thing is that like trans people haven't had a great history of like being access to publishing, access to, you know, there are some trans academics who do stuff, and there's activists who do stuff like blogs. A lot of trans community knowledge is spread in like Facebook, secret Facebook groups, or like on Twitter, these ephemeral spaces. And so a lot, one of the aims of the book was to kind of take these arguments that I had read and come to under, you know, because I did a lot of research when I transitioned myself about like, how do I counteract this argument? What is the explanation for this? What do we say if someone puts this stupid argument to you? And I guess over years I've built that up, and I do obviously when I'm using other people's written arguments, I do cite them. But yeah, for me, I felt like what I was trying to do was archive as well, as much as I make an original argument, which I do in terms of the structure and the voice of the book, is that some of the content, it's like to actually just put it all in one place, because trans people might know where to find these things, but certainly like no one outside trans community seemed to know, and cis people didn't seem to know. So to try and put all of these arguments into one place, put them into a logical order, make them legible, because obviously we all use jargon. If you're in a sort of subgroup, you know, there's things that way that trans people references jargon that we all use with each other that wouldn't make any sense to someone completely unacquainted with the topic. So there's a bit of a translation aspect to it too. But like that's the main element of what I did. It wasn't like that no one had thought of these arguments before. In fact, they had. It was more of a kind of platform problem than a intellectual problem, I think.
Yeah, and it really feels like that, because it feels like, I remember I was reading this thing someone was saying about how news has lost the art of the long read. I think it might even be a Radio 4 show where they kind of like summarize what has happened over 6 years of a story, and let's actually get six or seven people in a room and like, you know, let's discuss the story a bit more coherently rather than this fast throwaway thing every day. And if you look at the way that trans rights are spoken about, it is very newsy and it's quite throwaway. And then I feel like you just sort of came in and went, I felt like I was watching someone lay like aces out on a poker table. Don't even know if you do that. But it was like, look at this, like, look at trans life now. Look at what you're doing to sex workers. Look what you're doing in prisons. Like, look at this. Like, how is no, you just sort of zoomed out and went, this is an ace. Like, you are unable to deny this.
I'm sure some people can, but yeah, I know what you
mean. Well, yeah. I mean, that's the chilling thing. But it's like, that's what it makes it feel like it was staring you in the face all along, which I know we knew it was, but
mean that's really good to hear. I mean, I'm grateful to hear that, of course, because that is what I was intending to do. Is that like, yeah, archiving is, that's the thing with any marginalized community or minority community, is that there's a problem of history and of archiving too. And I use history a lot in the book. And yeah, I think those things are very powerful to like to both, you know, cite things within history. So I use a lot, couple of like fun anecdotes from history to illustrate points at times, but also take a holistic view. And I was really impressed by writing that I'd seen do that for other groups. So like, I mention it all the time, but like, why I'm no longer talking to white people about race with Rennie Adelogis, but it's funny because I know Rennie now. But when I read that, like, I was someone that felt like I was probably pretty clued up on like the nuances of how racism works and things like that, and felt like I was engaged with that conversation even before that book came out. Not my whole life, but like in my adult life, maybe. You know, I was really appreciative of the fact that, like, yeah, there was a lot of stuff, and it was really British as well, because a lot of stuff was seemed to be borrowed from America, and a lot of things I'd learned about microaggressions, how racism functions as institutionally, not just like people shouting slurs in the street. Yes. I'd learned from like following people on social media or whatever, but it was really good to have like a text that you could either give to other people or refer back to, and that was rooted in like Black British history, because I'd never read that history. I mean, I was never taught that in school. And I knew a little bit about Martin Luther King and American stuff from film and cinema, but I didn't know anything about you know, I grew up in Bristol, and she mentions the Bristol bus strike or whatever. And it was like, well, you know, I grew up in that city and I didn't know anything about that. So that had really impressed me, as had Revolting Prostitutes by Juno McAmory-Smith. And again, like, yeah, the same thing about sex worker arguments. And so, and I use both of those books. I refer to them both in my own. And yeah, I just thought, well, no one's done this for trans, particularly British trans people. And what was happening in the media was a lot of articles. When you say it's quite newsy, what a lot of articles were was like, it would be about J.K. Rowling and how awful it's been for her being cancelled or whatever. And what it would open up with is like, well, we all know trans people are discriminated against, but what about women who are being silenced? And I remember thinking, why is it that obligatory sentence being like, well, we all know that trans people discriminate? I was like, I don't think we do. I don't think actually, because all that ever happens is that everyone refers to the fact that trans people are discriminated against as an offhanded thing before they start talking about what the problem with us is. And I was like, well, actually, I never read it laid out anywhere, the ways in which specifically trans people are discriminated against. Like, sometimes people would just be like, oh, yeah, well, they, like, honestly, and then I've been surprised about, like, how many people don't realise, like how much trans people struggle to get a job. And I'm like, what did you think the discrimination looked like? Like, so I think I was keen to lay that out, basically.
Because 50% of people who are trans hide it at work, is that right?
If they're in work, 50% will hide it, which I think either that's hiding it, like they don't, you know, if they hide as the sex they were assigned at birth, or they've transitioned and then they conceal the fact that they were assigned a different sex at birth. And I know people who fall to both of those categories, like just personally. And it's easy to understand why. There can be still a lot of hostility. I have one friend, and I obviously won't say exactly what industry she works in, but she does a very, I love it because she does like a very aggressively normie job. She's like, I love the fact that she's like in a very normie job in London, and she's stealth, so no one knows that she's like a completely erratic transsexual behind scenes. And but like, you know, I have a lot of you know, I get a lot of hostility in my work, but because everyone knows everywhere I go, obviously it's like part of my brand to sound trans, is, you know, one thing that she has to experience sometimes is people saying really transphobic things, not knowing there's a trans person in the room. And I feel like that must be really, really hard, because it's like, well, it's a constant reminder that, you know, like, because people aren't going to say, like, people might be talking shit about behind my back, but I'm gone. I prefer that. Like, I'm out of the room. Like, if you want to be like that, there's that shemale. But like, yeah, it's a very different thing. And then also, if you want to transition, you're hearing your colleagues say that, how are you? It's not exactly an inviting space to come out and start transitioning at work, is it? That's like one example. And then there are just some people, particularly if they're working class, particularly if they're people of colour, particularly if they're not able to blend in as much and are more visibly gender non-conforming, who struggle to get jobs at all. And that's why a lot of people do sex work.
Yeah, and also the, you know, you're saying, oh, people go, oh, you know, oh, everyone knows that the trans people are scrutinised against. But the embeddedness of the transphobia, one of the things you reminded me of in the book that I am so staggered to remember, because I remember it, is that TV show There's Something About Miriam. That was, what channel was that on? Because you didn't,
it was
say
on what, like Sky One or whatever, wasn't it? It was on a Sky channel, I remember, because we had Sky. My mum did fork out for that, and then I remember watching it.
So if you don't mind, and it's not a traumatic thing to describe, will you just remind people who don't know about this show what it was about, because I remember it.
Yeah, so there was a so there was a sort of bizarre trend in like early noughties when reality TV was really big, where like obviously every production company, it was the height of Big Brother, but like every TV production company, it was really the height of reality TV. And there was like this whole genre of reality TV show that liked to, basically based on like shenanigans around sexuality. Like there was one called Playing It Straight, where there were all these men and the women had to guess which of them were gay and which of them weren't. It was with like June Sarpong. And I remember like June Sarpong.
Was June Sarpong involved?
Yeah, she was like holding up a, it wasn't like that homophobic. I mean, I don't know, I haven't seen it in through the eyes of 2021. I mean, we probably would all find it a bit problematic now. But there was like a really funny thing where I remember like Jun Sarpong hanging up, holding up a pink shirt, being like, what about this then? Seems gay.
What, trying to like smoke them out? Like, oh my God.
It was called Playing It Straight in Britain, but the original Dutch version was called Herken de Homo, which is literally Find the Homo. Anyway. Yeah, so there was this like whole genre of it. So there's something about Miriam wasn't the only one, but I would argue it's probably the cruelest one. And so there's something about Miriam. Obviously, you can probably get what it was referencing in terms of the film. And Miriam Rivera was a 21-year-old Mexican model, very feminine presenting, very beautiful. But she was trans, and as they stressed heavily throughout, she had not had lower surgery, so she still had a penis, and. It was kind of like, yeah, this show where the men were competing to go on a holiday date with her, £10,000 prize and a holiday with her. And so like all these challenges, and it had like multiple episodes. And obviously the audience knew that she was trans and they didn't. And that was like a big thing. And they were very keen to sensationalize every time someone made out with her. Some of them like, you know, kissed and caressed her or whatever, or like got close to sex. And it was all this, ooh, they're being gay and they don't know. And then the final finale is like she picks the man that was won. And he's like elated or whatever. And then she reveals she's trans. And then like all the other men are like still in the background, they all start laughing at him, and he looks like he's like, I don't know, someone's shot his entire family, and she just looks, you know, like mortified. It's just very, very cruel television. And then what happened after is a lot of the men sued the production company for sexual assault, for, you know, it was very exploitative, right? Like it was exploitative of the men, it was exploitative of Miriam Rivera. And but like a lot of the reviews blamed Miriam, right? Like that she was ultimately, you know, like some kind of, you know, deceiver and deceptive and really cruel person. In reality, she was a 21-year-old who probably thought she could, you know, she could make it on TV or whatever. Or she was clearly very exploited. But it was deeply cruel television. And it was actually I don't say this in the book, but it's probably the first time I can remember seeing a trans woman on television. And that's quite sad, because it was the year before Nadia was on Big Brother and won Big Brother, which was better representation, if you like. But I mean, I guess I didn't, because I didn't know that I was going to ultimately be a trans woman and transition and live as a woman at that time. But like, as first introductions to the concept of what a trans woman is, it was pretty bleak. And certainly it did make me think, like it was one of many pop culture references about trans women and men, that when I transitioned after a few years as a trying to be a kind of very gender non-conforming twink, I really thought that was going to be the end of my sex life, because I, you know, really, really like impaired my confidence about the likelihood that I would ever have a normal dating life. I'd seen like Miriam was one of many depictions of trans women basically being like revolting to straight men, or like having to deceive them, or, you know, whatever. And that, like, you know, basically the idea of men like either heaving, being sick or laughing or whatever is going to be your reality. And the reality that's not true. And I think that's probably changed now, hopefully a bit for younger, I can't speak for trans men, but for trans women, I think it's probably a little bit better now because there are more positive TV cultural representations of trans women who are attractive and not a joke, and, you know, all that stuff that you kind of need to see.
And you know, it just illustrates how baked in it was, you know, like it was that transphobia was so baked in that it's sort of almost invisible, and therefore how far we've yet to go. And you mentioned that felt like it was painting out your future, but I think it's important to note that hasn't been your reality at all, has it? You know, and you've you know, you've dated and had a brilliant time with many people who adore you for the person you are, you know, like
many people. You call me a slag.
It's on your Instagram bio, Sean, don't blame me.
Well, it's true. And the thing is that, you know, this is what's bizarre too, right? Is that like, if we want to go there, is that like, people would be surprised. I mean, what's funny is that people would be surprised how little I think, and things are changing rapidly too. It's like actually being trans has not really impeded my dating life at all. And especially it was me that was impeding it, and the confidence and the narratives. I mean, like, yeah, I have to set high standards, and there are men who could be either fetishistic or chasers or whatever, or would see me but wouldn't see, you know, but I just have too high standards. Obviously, I have evolved self-esteem, and I don't, but like women generally have to have. So straight men are terrible. But it's not what I thought, you know, not what I was raised by the culture to think trans life would be like, what trans dating would be like, or how I'd be sexually perceived, how my own body would be perceived, about how I would view myself. And that's not just about sex or romance. That's just about like, yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, we shouldn't all be consumed with having to be like, I'm not saying everyone has to feel amazingly beautiful all the time, but if you're actually only ever come to understand people like you as grotesque or repulsive, that's a very different thing. And that's just not true. And I think the poses and the euphorias and, you know, people like Hunter Schafer and India Moore and people like that, they really are, you know, in the amount of people now in public life, I think they're changing the perception as well for younger trans people.
A lot of the time you hear saying something which is incorrect, but I'd love to talk to you more about, which is that, oh well, trans liberation is kind of just gay liberation with a 20-year, you know, snooze button on it. And actually we were sleepwalking into that, and it's incredibly different. And I think that's something about Miriam illustrates that, because that kind of show has not been made about gay men. Maybe similar but different, you know, never quite like that. And how do you feel about it when people say that, and what do we need to learn?
So I can see where there are some parallels. The idea of sexual deviance, and like, you know, it was really, really bad in the 80s and 90s. People really, really have forgotten how terribly gay people, generally lesbians too, but like obviously with the AIDS crisis, gay men particularly were talked about and in the media. But yeah, I think the wariness about that 20-year time mark is it allows like a certain complacency, like, oh, history will just unfold itself.
We'll sit it out. Yeah,
the right side of history will win. And it's like, yeah, well, actually, gay liberation hasn't completely won yet. It might be for like middle-class white gay men in London in the main, not all. But like, it still isn't really there for a lot of like, you know, gay people of colour, working class, you know, the fact that like with the housing crisis, I mean, like if you're kind of like from a high-rise flat in London or whatever, and you can't afford to move out or whatever, how are you able to kind of express your gay identity? How are you able to like enjoy sexual freedom? All that sort of stuff isn't the case for a lot of types of gay people. So it's not fully achieved. And then the other thing is that like, yeah, the 80s and 90s, but like we're in a very different political context. I mean, like capitalism's out of control, right wing. We have all, you know, we have social media, right, the ultra-right is able to propagandize like never before. You know, who would have thought someone like Trump? I mean, like, he's completely like unprecedented in many ways. And we've got a lot of crises facing capitalism and therefore humanity. That means that we're not in the same place we were in the 80s and 90s. The other thing too is just that there's less trans people. So I mean, if you look in certain sections of the media and stuff like that, I mean, like, there are some places where you'd be hard pressed not to find a gay person or a lesbian. But like, we're really, really tiny. I mean, like, we're just not going to ever be able to be as ubiquitous in some arenas as cis LGB people can be. And that's just a numbers game, unfortunately. So that makes it harder. And I think gender runs a bit more deeply into people's anxieties than even sexuality does. Because ultimately you can sort of make an argument with sexuality. I mean, within reason, you can argue that like, oh, it's about people's private lives. It's about like, people, you know, kind of like, and I'm not saying this is the argument that should be used for gay people, because it's not, it's the bare minimum argument. But if you were going to be pragmatic, it's like, well, it's what people want to do with their own lives. It's what people do behind closed doors. Not that homophobes have ever cared about that. But with trans people, I guess, is that how we order public space is so deeply gendered and binary.
Yes.
That we are asking for quite big, you know, some iterations of what trans people can be asking for, particularly non-binary people, can be quite a profound change in how we understand personhood. I mean, like when non-binary mm-hmm. people say, I'm not a man or a woman, that's really hard for some people to accept, to grasp, because we've had a gender binary that has shaped human culture for certainly thousands of years in most societies, or certainly the society that kind of European and North American culture it comes from. And so that it runs a bit more deeply. So I think what trans people need a little bit more is, I mean, we're lucky, I think it's been really positive, actually. The anti-trans backlash has made, especially younger cis LGB people, I think a little bit more clued up and a little bit better. Because I can remember, you know what? I can remember before I transitioned, I had he wasn't really a boyfriend, so that would be too grand a title, but I was dating someone. So he was a gay guy, because that's what I was living as at the time. And I don't think, I imagine he wouldn't now. He worked in like East London, he worked in fashion or whatever, but he used to use the word tranny all the time. And he used it about drag queens, but also about transsexual people, but it was ignorance, right? And I remember like having read a bit about it and being like, I don't think you should use that term. I think trans people find it offensive. And he was a bit like, you know, he was young, so he was like, whoa. But I think that's very 2012. And I think if you look like 10 years on, I do think you would hear more cis LGB people pick someone up on that and say, you know, that's not acceptable language. Like, you wouldn't hear that around East London now. You don't get drag nights that have that slur in the title, which you did. And I'm really pleased. you know, small mercies is that, like, one of the things that's been good, I think, is that this backlash, I think a lot of gay and bisexual people and lesbians have seen the backlash, been reminded of maybe how it reminds them of older homophobia, and have kind of clued up a bit. I mean, obviously the book pushes people to go a bit further, because I always think people can do more. I mean, I can do more for groups that I don't belong to, and similarly I think gay and lesbian, bi people can do, who are cis, can do more for trans people too, and I hope the book will help some people to do that, or like understand more of the issues.
Yes, and this might be just an irritatingly dumb question, but one that I think it's worth marking, is that why does someone being trans become an existential question for people who aren't experiencing it? And why, if there's the person who has a like a skin condition where they can't go in sunlight, right? No one asks an existential question about why that is the case with them. But with someone being trans, it's like, well, what does this mean for everybody else? And is that gender? Is that the moral panic? Is gender-based?
Yeah, it is gender-based, because we have had a very powerful binary. I mean, these ideas, the idea of patriarchy, a system of male domination, and, you know, it's based on this idea that, like, you know, you were born with these genitals and this reproductive system, and this is how you should behave. And gay people are caught in that, and all women are caught in that, like, because, you know, if it's like, whether it's about reproductive rights, whether it's about contraception, or whether it's about whether women should be like at work rather than like, you know, having babies their entire adult lives until they die, like people like my grandmother, great grandmother. Yeah, I mean, it affects everyone. So everyone fights against these roles, unless you're like, you know, some ultra patriarch straight man. But yeah, that binary thinking still really subsists. And there's as much that it confirms for us about how the world should be, how we structure ourselves, and what we intuit about other people. You know, it's the first thing we want to know about someone is their gender, usually. And it's the first thing we intuit, you know, and we attribute, you know, that's why pronouns are so significant, obviously, is we attribute gender to someone immediately. And that's deeply ingrained. So any asking of a relinquishing of that binary way of imprinting gender on our culture seems very threatening to many people. For a variety of different reasons.
And you draw lots of those parallels in the book, don't you, as well?
Yeah. What I kind of am at pains to say in the book is that, like, gender variance is what I call it, rather than transness, because transness is a term that kind of came into being at a certain point in time, about 100 years ago, really. So before that, there were people we might call trans nowadays, but they didn't call themselves that, and the term didn't exist. But they led, like, cross-gender lives, or they led gender variant lives. And that's always existed in humanity. And what happened, you know, at this particular point in history is that the, you know, medical profession decided to take over a certain subset of people who might be gender nonconforming and pathologize them, and to say, well, okay, if you've got this dysphoria and you need to kind of have healthcare to feel more comfortable with it, we're going to gatekeep, we're going to create this category transsexual or transvestite, and we're going to basically say that you're delusional or whatever. We'll give you this healthcare so you don't kill yourself, but you're delusional, you have no clue about this, you're mentally ill. And that's the trajectory. And trans people are only starting to dismantle that pathologizing narrative about ourselves now. And the trouble with that is when you say about the skin condition, the why, is that I think when it's things about mental, you know, if it's conflated with mental illness, it's the same as when people go looking for a gay gene. I mean, you'd hope now that people can't be fucked, because it would be like, well, why would you need to know what a gene is? Because what's the problem? Like, looking for the gene, looking for a cause suggests that you're going to try and find a solution. So it's pathologizing. So like, wanting to know is this preoccupation of people who just fundamentally, I'm very suspicious of people who really want to, really are interested in why trans people exist or what gender identity is or whether it's innate or not. Because to me, it's like, who cares? Because I wouldn't want to be not trans now. I would want a less transphobic society, but I don't want to, you know, I'm not interested in being cured. It's this view that we're like, that we're a bit like unfortunates, really, and that it'd be better if no one felt the way we do.
Yes.
And I find that deeply insulting, and you see a lot of it in culture, particularly around trans kids, is that it's always like, it'd be better for the kid to be cis. So the worst thing that could be possibly happen is we accidentally diagnose a cis child, because we'll ruin their lives. And actually, it's a really, really unhealthy way to view things. And I think there's a parallel with sexuality, isn't it? So I think in the 80s and 90s, gay campaigners had to be like, we're not recruiting, you can't turn someone gay. And I think what we're moving to, as that's become more accepted, you know, variance in sexuality, is actually, like we were saying right at the beginning of this conversation, is these things aren't that clean cut. More and more people are bi, more and more people behave in a bisexual way, more and more people identify as queer, more and more people, you know, I think would say, I wouldn't rule it out, you know, I'm primarily attracted to this gender, but like, I wouldn't rule it out. And I think there's a great, great expectation that maybe people aren't as straight as they thought they were. Similarly, I'm all for a society in which it would be fine for you to kind of like, you know, if you want to kind of have a go at transition and then you detransition and then you retransition, you know, life shouldn't be made any harder for you for that. And actually, we as a society should just be like, well, that's fine. You're not ruined. You haven't destroyed yourself, you know, provided that people have like autonomy about those things. To me, it's just like the idea that like transition is this really, really last resort thing. Or being leading a trans life is kind of like, it's the same thing. Like, oh, I wouldn't want my kid to be gay, or I wouldn't want my kid to be trans. Like, well, why not? And we're not there. I mean, I think people my age who are having kids, friends wouldn't care if their kids were gay, but I still think quite a lot of people would prefer to have a cis child. And I think that's a sign about how far things have to go.
Yes. And also everyone saying, oh, well, I'd rather it because out there are people who will ... And it's like, well, out there is actually also in here. So why don't you start acting like the world you want, how you want the world to be, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Can I talk to you about the Goldie Hawn vehicle, Death Becomes Her?
You can. So funny. I watched that with my friend Tam literally last weekend, because he had never seen it before. And I was like, I'm sorry. Like, how are you queer and you've never seen this film? Like, it's so funny because it's like one of my favorite films. It's one of Monroe Bergdorf's favorite films. It's one of Bimini Bombulash's favorite films. And it's one of Gina Dawson's favorite films. And I think it's one of Paris Lisa's favorite films. Like, you know, just as a roster of people, I think that's quite telling. And it's one of yours. That's good. Yeah.
I just love that film. And then I saw you post online, so it must have been a couple of years ago, saying how it's a film that really speaks to trans people.
Yeah, that was about a year ago.
Trans women, sorry.
Yeah,
was it a year ago? Yes.
Yeah. No, it was. It was about this time last year. It feels like longer because of the lockdowns, but yeah. Yeah, I wrote a piece because I think Vice wanted me to do some more culture stuff, and I was like, yeah, well, I wanted to talk about Death Becomes Her and why it's almost like, yeah, it feels like a lot of, well, like I've just listed them, like a lot of trans people love it.
For anyone who hasn't seen it, we just do a rundown of roughly what it's about and tell us the parallels.
So it's one of those films that like was a bit of a box office flop and then rose over the years as a kind of cult camp classic. But it was in 1992, and it's like an odd point, right? Because it's like for Meryl Streep, it's after the first wave of her career, but before like Meryl as we know her now, like post Devil Wears Prada, like her golden years of like being the only woman.
International treasure.
Yeah. So it's this weird midpoint in her career. And it's an unusual performance for her because obviously Meryl Streep is all very like restrained normally, and she's like fully very camp in this. And then Goldie Hawn as well. So they're playing two aging rivals, frenemies, who've known each other their whole lives, who bitterly despise each other, and constantly have fought over men. And Bruce Willis is the kind of last man that Meryl Streep steals from Goldie Hawn, driving her completely insane when Meryl Streep steals her fiance. And so, a few years later, Goldie Hawn has been plotting revenge against Meryl Streep for about 14 years. And unbeknownst to Meryl Streep, she's aging. She's an aging actress, isn't she? And she's kind of, her career is over because she's no longer young and beautiful. And there's a sorceress played by Isabella Rossellini who has.
Yes, I totally forgot she was in it as well.
So Isabella Rossellini gives Meryl Streep a potion that will make her young and beautiful forever and immortal.
That's it.
Unbeknownst to Meryl Streep, Goldie Hawn also has managed to get this potion and drink it in order to kind of become beautiful and to plot revenge. And she's plotting to kill Meryl Streep with and then basically that hilarity ensues. Basically, all that happens is that they both attempt to kill each other. They destroy their bodies, but they're still immortal, so they walk around as corpses, and they have to constantly paint themselves, touch themselves up with paint and with like hardware stuff, because they're basically like grayed out rigor mortis corpses that happen to be like ambulant and sentient. And yeah, it's just very, very camp, because obviously they're just like bitter rivals. And the film, yeah, has been really popular with drag queens always since its kind of cult revival. And the reason that I said it appeals to trans women and the same thing, and like, you know, and trans feminine people or drag queens like Bimini. One, it's camp. Everyone loves Meryl and Goldie. They both look amazing in it.
Great outfits.
But it's all about like creating yourself and defying the laws of nature. Like, you know, it's about the idea that you can just say, you know, the obsession with being beautiful and young, glamorous forever. It's this kind of fantasy that like a lot of people, I think, live in. And then, the breaking the rules of nature to live forever. I mean, like trans women sort of break the rules of nature. We're constantly tweaking ourselves, aren't we? there's a kind of joke that like trans girls only ever talk about men in surgery. But of course, I've written a book to dispute that. this idea, this youth obsession, you know, it probably speaks to trans people and trans women in particular. And yeah, the idea of defying nature and the idea of pursuing glamour and beauty above all else, even if it's kind of like, you know, a little bit codependent and insane. I think it appeals for that reason. And it's, you know, obviously I loved it as like anything that turns out to be a queer classic. Like I loved it as a child long before I knew that it was like an archetypal queer classic. But anyone who hasn't watched it, I would recommend.
But I think also what I think is potentially what it is about it that speaks to the experience, the queer experience, is your two, like at the end of the film, there are these two women who've been bashed around to hell and back. Everything's dropping off them, but they've managed to sort of paint over it, and they've still got a few diamonds on, but their pits are dropping off them, but they have each other. And I think that's the thing about it, is like, you know, you get bashed around by the world, but you have each other. And that's kind of amazing, you know?
Yeah, and I think the other thing that appeals to queer people is, like, the idea of glamour and beauty is revenge. Like, I think, you know, if you look at, like, I think I say this in the Vice piece, is that, like, a lot of the reasons that, like, I've wanted to, like, look glamorous and look stylish and stuff like that in my life. It's like as a big fuck you to everyone that's basically been like, well, you're just going to be an ugly trans person forever. And I think for a lot of drag queens, I think that's why, you know, the really beautiful drag queens often say that. It's like they were bullied at school. They were just like, you know, and it was that they could assume this persona that's like this glamazon. And it's like a fuck you. Like you can't touch me. And I think that sort of like narrative is in the film too, isn't it? It's that they become like invulnerable to pain. Literally, by becoming like immortal and beautiful forever. But obviously there's like a price to be paid for it as well.
Do you know that saying, desire is the loss contained within it?
Yeah, I think I've heard that before, but let me think about that. Desire is the loss contained within it.
So it's like anything you desire is actually attached to something you feel you don't have, so that you lost, that you have loss for, so you yearn for it. It reminds me when Mickey Blanco came on this podcast, they said that when they, for the first time, dressed as a woman, they felt gorgeous for the first time in their life. And that was remarkable. And then Mickey's journey has been varied beyond that, because the way that Mickey identifies is very different now.
But yeah, like, it's very fluid,
So, but, you know, interesting.
It is interesting, I mean, I think that, I mean, Andrea Long Chu, the trans writer in the US, she talks about transition as desire. There's an essay called On Liking Women. It's very good. It's not that long. It's on N plus one. But it's so good about the, because, you know, we're always sort of made to think about transition and as being about like, oh, well, it's because I've got dysphoria, it's a medical condition, you have to treat me, you have to help me. And she's kind of like, well, no, what happens if it's just something people want? You know, like there are lots of things that, you know, you can desire a transition.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And that's fine. Like, you know, it's much, to me, that's a much more uplifting way to think about it. You can be one of we gorgeous, like, why not?
Yeah, because the rules are being made by the people going through it rather than being from the outside in. Sean, this has been wonderful.
Yeah, it's been good. We've covered so much stuff.
Yeah, haven't we? We covered quite a lot of ground. Not enough of Goldie Hawn's canon, if I'm honest. Well, if that wasn't nutritious and delicious, I don't know what is, because I love her. Email your comments and questions about that there interview, should you wish to, hello@homosapienspodcast.com. Get in touch on Instagram @homosapiens. Get in touch on Facebook @homosapienspodcast. Send us your agony uncle questions, of course, as always. Next week, we have got our Christmas special. You have all been writing in your stories of Christmas, because Christmas is a weird and different time for LGBTQ plus people. What does it mean to you? Do you have to go back in the closet when you go home for Christmas? Do you enjoy it? Do you dread it? Tell us your stories. All of that will be coming up. Plus, other very exciting things I'm not going to tell you about. It's going to be a surprise. I love you all. Merry Christmas. Bye now.
Powered by Spirit Studios.